Any honest religion of any flavor is supposed to expand and enlarge our souls and our minds and our understanding of the world. The result, if it's done right, is almost never a clear and unambiguous answer that all good people must follow. Instead, it's a broadening and deepening of our understanding so that our differences may be enriching and fertile rather than divisive. That is a noble goal. It is almost never achieved, and it's my goal this morning. Those of us here today represent most of the range of opinions on capital punishment. We still will when the sermon is over. Some here are deeply against it, considering it too barbaric to be defended. Some are strongly in favor of it and consider it a just and appropriate end for those who have committed the most heinous crimes. Most are somewhere in between. It's a complicated, emotionally loaded issue on which intelligent people of goodwill can and do and will disagree. As I've read religious arguments against the death penalty, I find that most religions, though not all, are against the death penalty. Their arguments are almost all variations of the same theme, which is that life is sacred. The creation story in the book of Genesis makes it clear that we were just dirt until God breathed life into us. So in Western religions, life is not only sacred, it's supernatural, a gift from God, not a product of nature. Of course, this idea that life is sacred has seldom been honored. Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, like the rest of the religions, have never had much trouble killing others of God's children, as all religious wars testify, and as we're still seeing today, this very minute, in the Middle East. And for Christians, Jews, Muslims, witches, Native Americans, and anyone else who got in the way of our manifest destiny to rule the world, have all been fair game for killing, sanctioned by God. So the reality has never matched the rhetoric. Still, the notion that life is a kind of sacred gift is in almost every religious argument against capital punishment, and it's emotionally appealing even if it's not historically common. The most coherent form of this argument that I know, and it's an argument I respect, though I don't agree with it, is the argument of the Roman Catholic Church. It's what they call their seamless garment argument for the sanctity of life. Catholics are officially opposed to killing life at any stage, whether in an abortion or a state-sanctioned execution. The reason, again, is that all life is a sacred gift from God, and so it is beyond our authority to destroy. That's the seamless garment that holds the sanctity of life as supreme in all cases. We're so used to hearing this that we tend to forget how ancient it is, this idea that life is sacred and that it had historical origins. The reasons life was considered so sacred aeons ago, especially the lives of males, it should be added, are easy to discover. Children represented more workers for the farming or herding through which the family fed itself, and survival was at stake. Children were the pension plan for their parents, expected to take care of them in their old age. Infant and child mortality were higher, so more children increased the chances that some would live to adulthood. You can hear behind all these an attitude of scarcity. Life is a fragile thing. And we can't forget how important it seems always to have been for men to have a boy to carry on their name. This was true in the ancient story of Abraham. It's been true through history. You can think of the English king, Henry VIII, as one of the most extreme examples. And it's true of many, many fathers today. And I'm not knocking it. I'm just observing that it seems to be a constant. And of course we think life is sacred because we're alive and we want to think there's something about us that's irreducibly sacred. All along, the notion of the sanctity of human life, which not all religions and not all cultures share, has been driven in part by a feeling of scarcity. A feeling of scarcity that was true 3,000 or 4,000 years ago. The fact that life was always precarious and we needed more people. It's a very ancient feeling, born at a time or before the time when the population of the world was less than 1/60th the population of the world today. Just to look at the population figures through history can give us a feel for what's changed and how drastically it's changed. Around 1400 BC, about the time traditionally assigned to Moses, the total population of the world is estimated to have been about 100 million, a little over a third the population of the United States today. By the time of Jesus, it had doubled to about 2/3 the population of the United States today. By 1200, in the Middle Ages, it had doubled again. So 800 years ago, the total population of the world was about the same as today's combined populations of the United States and Canada. Wars, plagues, high infant mortality, and early deaths still made life seem fragile, and high birth rates were still defenses against all kinds of both real and imagined extinctions. Then the pace picks up. In just 500 more years, by 1700, the population had again doubled to about 800 million people, less than the present population of China. The next doubling took only 2 centuries. And then, from 1900 to 1960, the world's population doubled again in only 60 years to about 3 billion people. And in the 36 years from 1960 to 1996, the population doubled again to over 6 billion people. Human life, which must once have seemed as rare as diamonds, now seems as common as pebbles. And today, all over our country and all over the world, in ways both large and small, our behaviors show that, in fact, we do not think of life as sacred or as something that automatically trumps all other considerations. There are a lot of examples of this. I'll take just a few. Abortions. Whether or not life is regarded as even desirable, let alone sacred, depends on whether we or the mother are willing to support it, to give it the time, energy, and money that it would cost to have it. I think these are the real arguments most women would make for abortions, and I think they are valid arguments. Furthermore, our society and the societies of almost all industrialized countries also treat life as something we can choose or not. Not only birth control, but also abortions, and now the growing availability of the RU486 pill, the abortion pill, have let our actions speak for us. Life is natural, not supernatural, and it's a choice, not a demand. Wars. many of which have been for economic advantage or power, show that in our hierarchy of values, the sanctity of life ranks considerably down the list. While many religious conservatives still argue that birth control and abortions are sins against God, it's a male God, I notice, even Roman Catholic women have abortions at the same rate as non-Catholic women. Life isn't that rare. We say no to life every day. We have higher priorities. No matter how ugly that sounds, it's true. We can mention other ways where we have chosen things that cost lives that we place far above the concern for life without any qualms at all. Tobacco is linked to nearly 500,000 deaths a year. Doesn't stop us from smoking. We could even mention, to go to the nearly ridiculous, that every year about 50,000 Americans will be killed in traffic accidents. We know that. We also know that we could probably save 49,537 of those lives, give or take a few hundred, by reducing the national speed limit to 10 miles an hour. That's the kind of laughter that would get in a vote. Nobody'd vote for it. We got more important things on our mind than life. No matter how ugly it is, it's how we act and who we are. So the ancient religious insistence that the mere quantity of life, even the possibility of life, is sacred, is no longer held by many people at all. We have shifted to valuing quality over quantity. That's a revolution. But a few romantic preachers aside, life has never been regarded as the ultimate value, sacred beyond compromise or cancellation. We've always believed that certain behaviors, certain social behaviors, are required of human beings, and that if you are dangerous to others, you may lose the right to live. Not to live in society, but even to live. One of the costs of living in any society is that we must give up some control to our society. It sets the rules, it draws the lines, and when we go too far over the wrong lines, all societies have and exercise the right to deprive us of our money, our freedom, our property, even our lives. Now, this idea, and I think there are many ugly ideas in this discussion, and this is one of them. This idea that some antisocial behaviors make us unfit to live has roots in one of the most misunderstood and mistaught stories in the Bible. It's the story of God's destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. I know you've heard the story, and I'll bet you've heard it wrong. The famous part of the story, which you probably know, is that a group of local men, like the cast out of the movie Deliverance, wanted to sodomize, as it's now called because of this story, a visitor to town. And that the visitor's host, after offering his daughter to the mob, finally gave the man over to be sodomized and murdered. When religious literalists say that God's destruction of the city was because of the homosexuality, they are misteaching the story. Many of them know it, and almost all biblical scholars know it. It's not what the story is about. The crime for which the city was destroyed was the crime of giving over a visitor to be murdered, the crime of not offering basic protection to a human being who came to you for help. The visitor wasn't a heretic, wasn't an enemy of the faith. He was just a human being with the right to expect civility and protection from other human beings. And the failure to provide that, according to whoever wrote this story, was a crime that made God so mad he destroyed the city. The people were no longer fit to live. You don't have to agree with this argument. but it does make the point that for all of recorded history that I know about, we seem to have found some people unfit to live because of their behaviors, whether you choose to call those behaviors antisocial, psychopathic, or evil. There seems to be something inside of us, in all cultures, I think, that sees certain criminal or psychopathic behaviors as putting us over the line, beyond the pale, and beyond the protection of fellow humans. When it's said this way, the idea sounds so foreign, it's hard for me to relate to, and I imagine many of you also find it foreign. For some of you, the idea that someone can do something so heinous that they're not fit to live will never be an acceptable idea and will always be vulgar. For others, apparently for quite a majority of Americans, it is a very acceptable idea. I want to see if I can help us relate to this idea, even if we'll never find it attractive. Otherwise, we can't understand half of the argument. To do this, I'll use two stories. One is strong but fictional. The other is true but weak. I suspect many of you watched the award-winning television miniseries Lonesome Dove a few years ago. I imagine it was required watching in Texas public schools. I think it was one of the finest and most powerful dramas ever aired on television. Some of that power came from the story. Some of it certainly came from the actors. Tommy Lee Jones, Robert Duvall, and Robert Urich are the three I'm thinking of, and they were involved in a very powerful scene that I want to remind you of as clearly as I can remember it. Robert Urich's character seemed to lack something essential, a moral center, a sense of right and wrong, a character. He fell in with two psychopathic murderers who tortured, killed, and then burned a farmer for fun. Urich didn't help with the killing. He was just there with them, watching and not stopping them. Kind of like the host in the biblical story of Sodom and Gomorrah. When Robert Duvall's and Tommy Lee Jones's characters found the murdered and burned farmer, they became agents of retribution. They tracked down and caught the three men. They were surprised and saddened to find the Robert Urich character among them, for he was their friend. Urich's character didn't seem to understand what he'd done wrong, one of the amazing moments in the series. "You crossed over the line," said Duvall. "I didn't see the line," said Urich. "I'm sorry," was the answer, and they hanged the three men. That's one of the most powerful scenes I think I've ever seen in television or in a movie. It has seemed to me very profound, with an insight into the nature of human nature and a deep sense we have of justice and of that line that can't be crossed. There is a line we cannot cross, and when we do, we are beyond the protection of society. According to the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, we're even beyond the love of God. Amazing. I think almost all of us know this line intuitively. What we do with people who cross that line is a political and legal decision. Is it worth spending money to keep murderers, rapists, and other psychopaths alive for 20 to 50 years? We know prisons will not rehabilitate them. Is that how a society wants to spend its resources? I don't think this is a question to which there's only one answer. If there is, I don't know what it is. Still, it is so hard to put ourselves in the place of the two cowboys in Lonesome Dove who hanged the three men. This is where the whole subject feels most likely to slip away from me, and maybe from you too. So I offer you a second story from my own past. You may decide it is a very weak analogy, and it is a very weak analogy, but it's all I have. 25 years ago, my wife and I raised purebred dogs. It was a fairly rare breed called Briards, French Shepherds. The males could stand up to 28 inches at the shoulder and weigh over 110 pounds. Like all sheepdogs, were fiercely territorial and protective. My wife was obsessive about the breeding, and she matched our females with the best bred stud dogs in the country, usually checking their breeding lines back 5 generations or more. Many of the puppies we sold later became champions in the breed. They were just wonderful dogs. They're still my favorite breed. But over a period of 4 years, 2 of the puppies we sold grew to become dangerous. One female was so protective that when her owner's 2-year-old daughter ran into the room in the middle of the night because she'd had a nightmare, the dog attacked her. The animal shelter called us the next day when they recognized the breed. My wife was the only breeder of that breed in the state. And we picked up the dog and brought it home. Of all the dogs we bred, that's the only one I ever got to name. Her name was Merseydotes. A couple years later, a big male dog, a very big male dog, simply had something wrong with him. He was like a dog version of a psychopath. My wife and I both felt completely safe around this huge dog, and I think we were completely safe around him. But he chased and bit 2 children, and then without any warning, he attacked a friend of ours during a bridge game in our home, tearing open his face so badly it took over 30 stitches. The friend was a professional photographer, and he nearly lost an eye. I don't have to tell you that these dogs crossed over that line for dogs. You know that. And you probably know what happened next. You've heard these stories before. Both times, I took the dogs to the vet and had them killed. I don't like euphemisms for this. They weren't put to sleep. I paid to have them killed. I had to feed these dogs tranquilizer pills so that they wouldn't be a danger to the vets or the teenagers working with them. And I will tell you, without shame, but with memories that are still strong enough to tear my heart out, that I cried like a baby all the way to the veterinarian's office and all the way back. We had had such high hopes for these animals. They had the best breeding, the best food, excellent obedience training. I don't know that we could have done any more for them than we did. Anybody here who's owned a pet knows how much we can love animals. And both my wife and I loved all the dogs, even these 2, Merseydotes and George. We could have chosen to build on to the kennel. We could have chosen to keep these dogs separate from the other dogs and from our friends and keep them alive for the rest of their lives. It wasn't worth it. We didn't consider it. We didn't have that much money or space, which is to say, there were other ways we preferred to use what money and energy we had. But we shed many tears over these animals who had done terrible things, had crossed over that line, and who we chose to execute. I don't want to imply, even for a second, that I equate dogs with people. It's a different order of being. I tell you the story partly to say that I know what it's like to decide to kill a dangerous animal, even one I loved. Our reasons for killing the dogs were reasons of money, space, and priorities. which not surprisingly seem to be high on the list of reasons used by people who argue for the death penalty. The subject of executing human psychopaths, murderers, and dangerous people who've crossed over that line isn't this simple. There are several dimensions of the debate on which we would probably all agree. While there isn't time to go into a lot of them, I need to mention some of them. The legal system that sentences and executes our prisoners is imperfect. Blacks and other minorities, but especially blacks, are both imprisoned and executed in disproportionate numbers. I don't know how much is race and how much is economics. I suspect that much of it reflects the fact that poor people die in disproportionate numbers both in and out of prisons. They can't afford the best lawyers, the best doctors, the best education, the best health care, or the best of anything else. American children raised in poverty are up to 5 times more likely to die of various causes than the children of more privileged families, regardless of their race. The system isn't adequate and it isn't fair, and we all know it. Second, some prisoners who are executed are innocent. Let's not play games about this. No human system is perfect, and this one isn't either. The legal system is a human institution. It'll never be perfect. We will always imprison and execute innocent people. We don't like to admit it, but innocent people die in almost every human endeavor we take. We're just not that perfect. In war, some soldiers are killed by what we call, incredibly, friendly fire. Any veteran knows that term. It means that our own troops mistakenly killed their comrades. You can add other lines to this list of the death of innocents. It's a very long list. But in almost every area, some innocent people die. However, even if we can't make the system perfect, it should be monitored and improved, and it has a long way to go. Third, it's also clear, I think, that capital punishment is no more a deterrent than prison time is a rehabilitation. I'm not interested in those arguments. I think they're bogus. It is retribution, punishment, and the vengeance of society. If there is a persuasive argument that either imprisonment or capital punishment are any more than that, I haven't heard it. There are more areas besides these three that we could probably all agree need to be addressed and improved no matter what our position is on the death penalty. But they don't change the basic issue of whether the most proper and desirable punishment for those who have crossed over that line is life imprisonment or execution. And I don't think many people on either side of this argument are likely to have their minds changed by argument, certainly not this morning. But in a society where so many of our laws and behaviors show that we do not consider the mere fact of life to be sacred, or even to trump many other considerations, I don't think the seamless garment argument of the Catholic Church and others is adequate or realistic or helpful. What troubles me with saying that is that I really like the idea of a seamless garment argument. I like the idea of a consistent attitude toward life that we could use for both abortion and the subject of capital punishment. I don't find it a black and white picture. I think it's all full of grays. It seems to me that the quality of human lives is like a bell curve. That's descriptive, not prescriptive. Most are precious. Some few are exquisite, even saintly. We can all think of some people in that category. And some at the other end have crossed over a line that even some of our most ancient religious teachers have believed to make us unfit to live. As ugly as that sounds to say and probably to hear, I believe it is true. In my personal opinion, I am somewhat surprised to discover is that I can't find any persuasive arguments against capital punishment, especially from religious writers. But that isn't enough. Even if you were persuaded by this logic, and if you weren't when you came in, you probably aren't now, it isn't enough. The intellectual arguments aren't enough for me, and I hope they're not enough for you. At least two more things are needed. First, since we will probably never agree on whether or not capital punishment is just, ethical, or moral, we must strive to broaden and deepen our understanding of the issues involved so that our disagreements can be insightful rather than spiteful, informative and enlightening rather than merely divisive. We need to understand that intelligent people of goodwill, people just as intelligent and just as moral as we know we are, can and do disagree on all complex issues, from abortion at the beginning of life to capital punishment as an end to life. But something is still missing. There is sometimes what seems to me like a hardness, even a smugness, from people on both sides of this argument. I listened to the last alleged debate between the presidential candidates. I liked Lonesome Dove better. And I have heard since then our Governor Bush's attitude described as smug, even taunting, when he bragged that in Texas murderers are killed. I don't know whether he feels that way. I hope he doesn't. It's too simple. And that attitude would make us miss what I think is the most important of all pieces and attitudes toward these prisoners who are condemned either to die or to rot away in hellish, inhumane prisons. What's missing are the tears. Even with the two dogs I had executed, I cried like a baby. God, there were so many hopes and dreams that died with those dogs. What I'm missing on both sides of this debate is that I want to know, where are the tears for the failed humans? Where are the tears for all the hopes and dreams that die every time we slam shut forever another prison door or kill another prisoner? I believe it is possible for good and moral people to decide that capital punishment is appropriate and just. The voting majorities in 38 of our 50 states and both our major presidential candidates apparently feel this way. But I do not believe that it should be possible for us to accept either the growing prison population or the growing number of prisoners we choose to execute without hurting so badly that we need to cry. Unless we feel and live with that horrible sense of loss of dreams and hopes and all that we have always wished were sacred about life, unless we have the tears, I think we will lose more of our own humanity than we can afford to lose. And to lose that degree of humanity is finally to experience the awful irony of having capital punishment execute a piece of our own soul and the soul of our nation.